Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. On Tuesday, August 4th, the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties of the House Oversight Committee held a Democratic roundtable on the Bill of Rights in the Balance, the deployment of federal troops against the American people. We're going to hear from a couple of the invited witnesses who briefed the subcommittee members in a moment. But first, Physicians for Human Rights held a webinar recently entitled Protests, Police Violence, and the Pandemic. One of the participants was Dr. Sebnem Kurşfinganji, a human rights defender and the president of the Human Rights Foundation of Turkey.
What we learned through this work, actually, maybe it would be a kind of way to discuss. We had built-in mobile infirmaries during Gezi protests. It was a protest, a demonstration against the government, just trying to build a mall instead of a park. Gezi Park, which is a place to breathe for all the people in Istanbul. So there were demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, but the police attacked in this sense. And we tried to share information for people, how to protect themselves from the crowd control weapons in this sense. And also in the infirmaries, we treated people. But not only treatment, also we provided documentation for the injuries during Gezi protests, which helped a lot, I have to admit, because then there were many compensation cases, and all of these compensation cases relied on the documentation of human rights violation, hundreds of compensation cases. And unfortunately, although we call the crowd control weapons less lethal or no lethal weapons, we had 8 people killed during these Gezi protests, just caused by direct impact of the crowd control weapons. 11 people lost their eyes and many other lost their vision and many injuries, of course. So we have to keep in mind that during this pandemic, they just use it as an alibi to attack people because they don't keep the physical distance, but police officers do not keep the physical distance. What would we call while they try to arrest people, handcuff from the behind, and just kill George Floyd in this way, and also about the detention places, for example, what do we know about the hygiene of these detention places where they would threaten public health regarding the pandemic?
That was Dr. Sebnem Kurşfinganji, a human rights defender and the president of the Human Rights Foundation of Turkey. She spoke recently on a webinar sponsored by Physicians for Human Rights entitled Protests, Police Violence, and the Pandemic. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On Tuesday, August 4th, the House Oversight Committee's Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties held a Democratic roundtable on the Bill of Rights in the Balance, the deployment of federal troops against the American people. The discussion was chaired by Congressman Jamie Raskin. One of the people who briefed the panel was Oregon State Senator Lou Frederick.
My name is Lou Frederick. I'm an Oregon State Senator from District 22 North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon Senate. I come to the issues before you from a very simple direction. I want to feel safe. I want to feel safe walking in my neighborhood, at the grocery store, downtown, on the beaches of Oregon, in our majestic forests, and in the small towns and high desert of my state. And if I do not feel safe and I need help, I want to not have anxiety about calling police to help me, because they might add to the threat regarding my life as less than human. It is very simple. In my life, I've had a police officer pull out his gun on me when I was a reporter and a passenger in a marked television news van. Until my hair turned gray, I was stopped at least once a year, often driving through my now gentrified neighborhood with the excuse that I looked lost. I worry each time a police officer pulls up behind me, worrying about whether I will live the rest of that day, depending on the mood of the cop or his need to show control and domination. I've had enough, and so have millions of others. The murder of George Floyd brought that reality of my existence and other Black men forward in ways we did not expect. It was no longer a mythical story presented by the Black community. It was a murder on camera by a smiling officer who was helped by three other officers around him. From Burns to Warrenton, Oregon, Umatilla to Coos Bay and Klamath Falls, tens of thousands of Oregonians marched to show their outrage at Floyd's death and the history of the lack of police accountability for excessive use of force against Black and brown people. Those that showed up were from across the demographic perspective. In Oregon, because of the low numbers of minorities living in the state, it was amazing and heartening to see white people of all ages and economic levels out on the street protesting for change. Those who wanted to discredit these legitimate concerns went to work immediately. For personal and clearly political reasons, agents provocateurs, already part of the mix of Portland demonstrations, moved quickly to create confrontations that they knew would prompt an overreaction from police forces. And then they quickly moved back to the back or the sides of some of the demonstrations to watch that conflict. Now, I've been watching these tactics develop for years. The last 70 days, it has been on display for those of us on the streets of Portland. And what has not been widely displayed has been the peaceful demonstrators constantly stopping dangerous activities. Instead, the media has spent most of its time in the middle of any conflict that develops because news focuses on the unusual, especially broadcast and visual media. The audience doesn't see the usual, since we no longer know about the usual. We think of the unusual as normal. But when a fluid is sprayed on the concrete in front of a marble building and flames for a minute, the cameras go there. Flames are more interesting, though they may actually have little impact or be put out by others. I'm asked often how I found my way to the Senate, to politics. My answer is always the same. When your first bout with tear gas is when you're 8 or 9 years old, social issues are going to be a primary point of your life. I spent my school years in the South, Atlanta, Baton Rouge, Tuskegee, and in civil rights demonstrations and committees. Dr. King was the father of my playmates. I marched regularly with John Lewis and Julian Bond and C.T. Vivian and a host of other civil rights icons. I was one of nine desegregating my high school. The tear gas in my past came from police towards peaceful, unarmed marchers. Some things have not changed in the years. With my help and others in the legislature, Oregon has banned the use of tear gas except in riot situations. And then the definition of riot was changed by officials. Even that level of conflict was diminishing until the Homeland Security forces were brought in. Their stated goal was to bring down the intensity of the situation, restore order, and protect federal buildings. No one bought that. The show of force with camouflage riot gear, no identification except police signs, and the Gestapo tactics of spiriting people away off the streets in unmarked vans with no charges only brought out greater numbers of outraged people to the demonstrations. Firing rubber bullets, pepper balls, tear gas canisters, and other projectiles at crowds of unarmed peaceful demonstrators only enraged Oregonians. Beating people on camera only confirmed the need to reform the police use of excessive force. The result of the attempted occupation was not what they expected. The administration got their B-roll footage for political commercials of armed officers in riot gear and a few examples of fences being attacked along with a few flames and boarded windows. But they also got hundreds of moms standing by, dads with leaf blowers, sending tear gas and smoke away from the unarmed protesters. As one person put it, when they fired pepper balls, we got vests. When they fired tear gas, we got gas masks. When they fired rubber bullets, we got helmets. When they fired all three, we made shields. I want to point out that all of those are defensive reactions to offensive tactics. The protective gear is not designed to hurt anyone. Before someone brings up water bottles and firecrackers thrown or dumpster fires or broken windows, I attended several marches, rallies and demonstrations in my neighborhood and in downtown around the 3 to 6 blocks near the courthouse. Standing in the front, middle, and rear of the demonstrations gives me a perspective that is not the same as the media you see, especially in the rear of the group. Back there, I recognize agents provocateurs from previous demonstrations, especially those associated with right-wing groups. In the past, wrist slingshots from behind the peaceful crowd were used to send ball bearings, over the heads of the demonstrators towards the police. I saw several people goad others towards the federal officers and then quickly move to the back of the crowd once they got close. One fellow in particular I recognized from previous demonstrations on the side of the right-wing militia crowd. I saw others handing out firecracker poppers that startle anyone, but especially folks in riot gear who are told that there are terrorists in the crowd. All of those designed to elicit a response, an overreaction to people in the peaceful crowd. But instead of generating fear, the crowd swelled from what had become several hundred to upwards of six to 10,000 in a week. And now that the feds have left the street, now that the numbers are dropping precipitously, as we return to discussing how we can make long-term lasting change in police accountability with screening, recruiting, training, tracking discipline, and changes in qualified immunity. We're making these changes. Those will be marched with an awareness of disparities in housing, healthcare, transportation, economic security, and opportunity. The virus has also highlighted in the last recent months. I'm going to close very quickly with a conversation I had several years ago that stays with me and motivates me daily. I was talking to a 10-year-old Black youngster who I'd known his entire life. After one of our horrendous shootings of a young man, he asked me a question. He said, "You have always told me that if I felt unsafe, I should call a policeman. But if I do, will they shoot me? I plan to change that future. I hope that you'll help. Thank you very much."
That was Oregon State Senator Lou Frederick. Timothy Snyder is a professor of history at Yale University and a leading scholar of authoritarianism and fascism, who also briefed the panel.
I'll be speaking about what I will call the unauthorized and unnamed federal secret police force, which is the best way that I can think of to categorize it. It looks like a secret police, so that's the term that I'm going to use. The three points have to do with the origins of this force, the nature of this force, in particular, how a secret police must always be in contradiction with the rule of law, and the consequences of such a force, in particular with respect to our elections this November. So, point number one about the origins. What we know about authoritarian regime change is that it doesn't usually happen overnight. It usually happens because high officials find loopholes in the law. They push the meaning of the law to its limits and beyond. They seek or create conditions of emergency, which they then exploit. This matches precisely the situation that we're in, where the head of the Department of Homeland Security hasn't been confirmed by the Senate, where the order to carry out violence was exceptionally vague, and where the justification for violence is also very hard to define. The justification, and this is the second troubling thing about the origins of these actions, is based upon an ideology. The fact that this violence is being used to protect monuments is not just incidental. I think it's actually rather central to what's going on. A monument is not a person, and in particular, a Confederate monument, or monuments that the president particularly likes, tell us a story about a certain kind of innocence in the country. They tell us a story about how it was the white people who were always correct. They tell us a story about how we, the white people, are the innocent ones, and the other people have always been on us. They have always been the aggressors. This tendency to replace the real concerns with real human beings with a mythical past has a name, and that name is fascism. When we move away from concern for law and individual rights and toward a story about myth and innocence which justifies violence, we're moving towards fascism. A second aspect about the origins of this, which is very troubling, is language. If one reads Mr. Trump's fundraising documents or listens to Mr. Trump or Mr. Wolf or Mr. Barr, the basis for these actions sound very much like a conspiracy theory. The idea that there are groups of, I'm using their words, terrorists or anarchists, is a very troubling notion, because these words are precisely the trigger words which have been used throughout the 20th century to signal that some people are outsiders, some people don't deserve the protection of the rule of law, some people don't really belong to the nation or the society or the body of citizens. It is all right, in fact, it's required, therefore, that we punish those people. Another feature of this language is that if they are terrorists and anarchists, that means that we are the victims. We're just defending ourselves. The final part of the origins, which is troubling, has to do with the personnel. Historically speaking, secret police forces have very often been drawn from two sources. The first of these is border zones. So, for example, in the Spanish Civil War, the troops which ended up being victorious in the far right were troops which have been fighting in a border zone, one of countless examples. In the case of German history, the origins of the SS are as concentration camp guards. Now, these may seem like esoteric examples until we remember that it appears that the men who are carrying out violence in Portland and the men who might carry out violence in the future come precisely from border zones. And if they've been working in our vast network of detention centers, they've also been working in lawless zones. In other words, they come from the places where historically secret police forces come. The dynamic is that men in border zones or men in lawless zones learn exceptional violent behavior, which and then they're turned against everyone. The second basic point I wanted to make has to do with the nature of a secret police force. A secret police force, by its nature, has to contravene the rule of law. A secret police force is characteristic not of a rule of law state, not of a republic or a democracy, but of an authoritarian or totalitarian state. Why? We've heard about why. Secret police forces break the laws, it's known. What happened to Mr. Pettibone is assault and kidnapping. Those are violations of the law. What's worse, if possible, is that when the secret police breaks the law, and we saw this in the response of Homeland Security, what will happen is that officials will say, everything we do is legal by definition. And that kind of retrospective justification is what destroys the rule of law. If whatever the secret police do is then excused or defended and described as legal because they did it, then the rule of law ceases to have any meaning. A second feature of the nature of a secret police is its unaccountability, which Mr. Pettibone and Mr. David have already stressed. You don't know how to react to unmarked people. You don't know if they're officers or not. And again, as Mr. David and Mr. Pettibone have both already stressed, these kinds of actions encourage imitation. It doesn't take much to rent a van, put on camouflage, and hurt people. That's an easy idea to have. And in the worst case, what happens is that the government-sponsored secret police and the paramilitaries end up in some kind of open or implicit cooperation. The final thing I want to say about the nature of the secret police that we've seen in this testimony is its unpredictability. It's intolerable not to know who you're confronted with. It's also intolerable not to know when you might be arrested and for what. Unpredictability is the definition of terror. Our encounters with law enforcement and with the government in general should be predictable. They should follow rules. The definition of terror is that you don't know if men are going to show up in the middle of the night and take you away. And this is unfortunately very close to what happened in Portland, all too close. In fact, it is what happened in Portland. The third and last point are the consequences. We're in a very particular historical moment now, where we have a chief executive who has never exhibited any support for the rule of law or for democracy, where we're in the midst of a terrible economic collapse, and where we're also in the midst of a pandemic which has caused mass death. As others have already mentioned, the images created by violence, the images of provoked violence, have been used in Mr. Trump's electoral propaganda. They've been used in his ads. They've been used in his fundraisers. And the final way, or the most specific way this is alarming, is in connection with his tweet of 30 July, the one in which he called for delaying the elections. Now, sometimes we comfort ourselves by saying he can't do that himself. But of course, no leader can ever do anything by himself. What matters is the response. Those three question marks at the end of that tweet are a call for help. They're an appeal to Americans. What can we do to make a mess of these elections between now and September, now and November? And I'm afraid that we have to consider this new, unaccountable, unnamed federal secret police force as one agent that might respond to that appeal. Again, historically, it's very often the case that authoritarian regimes arise during an election which is messed up. The final point, and here I'd like to echo something that Lou Frederickson said, the essence of all of this is that racism can't be reconciled with democracy. Racism in the United States most directly affects Blacks and people of color, But so long as we have prevalent racism in the country, democracy is also impossible for the rest of us, which is how all of this, I believe, fits together. Thank you very much.
That was Timothy Snyder, a professor of history at Yale University, a leading scholar of authoritarianism and fascism, who was briefing a Democratic roundtable held by the House Oversight Committee's Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. The roundtable was entitled The Bill of Rights in the Balance, The Deployment of Federal Troops Against the American People. And finally, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, a nonprofit law firm based in Portland, Oregon, put together a guide to your rights while protesting and how to handle an interaction with police.
I'm Juan Chavez. I'm an attorney at the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
And I'm Franz Brugmeier, also an attorney at Oregon Justice Resource Center. We're going to talk to you about your right to protest, what the police can and can't do to you, and how to hold them accountable for misconduct or abuse toward you or someone else.
Knowing your rights won't always stop an injustice, but it will vaccinate you from suffering more harm and help you protect others. So let's start with your rights as a protester. It's important to know what protections you have under the law and how they intersect with the powers of the police.
You have the fundamental right to protest and seek changes to laws and government practices under the U.S. and Oregon constitutions. However, that right can be reasonably restricted in public forums depending on where, how, and when you are restricted.
When you are lawfully present in any public space, you have the right to record, whether it's through photos, video, or audio. This includes the right to record the police, provided you are not deemed to be interfering with their operations. Taking pictures or video from a safe distance is not interfering with the police. That said, if police are telling you to move back, do so and keep slowly retreating while filming until they stop telling you to move. Everyone else at the protest also has the right to record, which means they could take pictures of you. Simply being present at the protest is your consent to be recorded. The person who takes the image can decide how to use it, including sharing it on social media.
Here's some tips to prepare yourself for protesting. Before you leave home, make sure you're stocked with water, snacks, and any medications you need. Write on your body in marker that won't rub off the phone number of one or more jail support organizations. Wear a mask to help protect yourself and others from COVID-19. Disable facial and fingerprint recognition on your phone. Use a numeric passcode instead and use an encrypted app to communicate, or leave your phone at home. Leave jewelry, valuables, drugs, and weapons at home. Bring a buddy and stick together. Don't interact with the police as far as possible. Especially don't take selfies with them, high-five them, hug them, kneel with them, or anything else.
Let's talk about police now and what they can and cannot do at a protest.
Always remember that there are a lot of things that police are not lawfully able to do, but they do anyway. Police can't lawfully use force against protesters who are simply expressing themselves.
If police are violating your rights, always assert your rights, but deal with the violations later. Listen carefully to what police say during the protest. They are required to give you a chance to leave if they tell you to leave. If you're concerned about getting arrested, move away. Walk across the street. Leave the immediate area. That said, you might not get a warning. Shutting down a protest through an order to disperse must be a last resort for police. There should be a clear danger of riot, or if the interference with traffic, unlawful activity, or another immediate threat to public safety causes public alarm. The order needs to be clear and audible, including how much time you have to leave, which way to go, and what happens if you don't leave. If police give an order to disperse, they have to give you a reasonable opportunity to follow their instructions, including time and exit path.
You don't have to answer police questions. You don't have to show ID unless you're driving a car. If police stop you, ask if you're free to go. If they say yes, calmly walk away. If they say no, ask why you are being detained. Police must be able to put their reasonable suspicion of your alleged criminal activity into words. If the police are detaining you with reasonable suspicion, you must provide your name, address, and date of birth. You do not have to say anything else.
Stay calm. As difficult as can be, keep your hands visible and away from your body. You never have to consent to a search of yourself or your belongings. However, police are allowed to pat down your clothing or search within your reach in a vehicle if they think you have a weapon. If you're arrested, they can search you. If the police ask to search you, say, I do not consent to a search. It can be dangerous or illegal to physically resist a search, but you should not verbally consent. You should say clearly that you do not consent, because silence gives police your consent. Police can't confiscate or demand to see your recordings unless they have a warrant. They can't delete data under any circumstances.
Courts have upheld that cops can pretty much say anything to a detainee they are questioning in order to get information. That includes lying. For example, you may hear, your friend already told us what you did, so you might as well admit it. Do not engage. If you get arrested, don't say anything other than asserting your rights. You have the right to remain silent. Use it. Ask for a lawyer immediately. Say clearly, I wish to remain silent. I want an attorney.
You do have the right to ask why you are being arrested, but don't get into a debate with the officer about the response. Even if you have chosen to remain silent, you do still have to answer the booking questions. Let the officer know immediately if you have a medical condition that needs attention. This is important. Do not sign anything that waives your rights or makes any admissions about your conduct at the protest without an attorney present. Do not tell the police your immigration status. You are not required to. You have the right to a local phone call. If you call your lawyer, the police cannot listen in. But if you call anyone else, they can, and it may be recorded and used against you.
Here's what to do afterwards if you experience police misconduct or abuse. Write down everything you can remember about what happened and who was present. Take pictures or video to document. If your clothes are damaged or destroyed in some way, save all of your clothing in a plastic bag. Don't wash it. Keep hold of relevant documents or information, such as medical records. Think about who witnessed what happened and might be willing to give an account of what they saw. By doing all these things, you're creating evidence that may be useful should you end up filing a legal claim against police. Remember, the evidence that you're creating could become public during the lawsuit. You have 2 years to file a claim.
We hope these tips about exercising your right to protest are helpful. If you want to report anything you see or experience in an interaction with law enforcement while protesting, email us at info@ojrc.info. Your information will be kept confidential unless you give us permission to share it. Thank you, and keep protesting.
That was Your Rights While Protesting and How to Handle Police, a resource from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Find written materials and learn a lot more about OJRC at their website, www.ojrc.info/yourrighttoprotest. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you've been listening to Prison Pipeline. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.
Some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul's intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.